Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California's Voice of Reform Project, promoting informed discussion of issues related to California state governance and civic engagement. I am David Lesher, California Program Director for the New America Foundation and your chair for today. Today we'll discuss the notion of a California Citizens Assembly, an officially constituted group of citizens carefully selected to represent California's great diversity and empowered to make recommendations to voters about specific political reforms. The Commonwealth Club's Voices of Reform programs are made possible by the generous support of the James Irvine Foundation, the Wallace Alexander Gerdobi Foundation, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and Commonwealth Club members. Today's program is co-sponsored by the New America Foundation, a nonpartisan think tank supported by the James Irvine Foundation and based in Washington, D.C. and Sacramento that seeks to bring together the political right and left with new policy ideas that recognize our future technology, demographics, and economics. Our program will be moderated by Judy Nadler, Senior Fellow in Government Ethics at the Marcula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University and former Mayor of Santa Clara. And now I'm very pleased to turn the program over to Judy Nadler.
Well, as you've heard, today we'll discuss this notion of a California Citizens Assembly, an officially constituted group of citizens carefully selected to represent California's great diversity and empowered to make recommendations to voters on specific political reforms. And to assist us today, we have an outstanding group of gentlemen as our panelists. Let me introduce them first, and then they can begin speaking. Our first panelist is Gordon Gibson. Gordon was elected twice to the British Columbia Legislature, where he served as leader of the British Columbia Liberal Party. Prior to elected office, he served as assistant to the Minister of Northern Affairs and then the executive and later special assistant to the Prime Minister, and then ran in three federal elections, keeping very busy. Mr. Gordon is a senior fellow in Canadian Studies at the Fraser Institute, where he studies federalism, governance, and Aboriginal non-Aboriginal relations. He is the author of Fixing Canadian Democracy and 30 Million Musketeers, A Canada for All Canadians. And he is also a regular contributor to the National Post, where he provides political commentary on current issues. In 2002, Mr. Gordon was commissioned by the British Columbia government to design the Citizens' Assembly on Electoral Reform, and his proposal was adopted by the Assembly, which led to the creation of the Citizens' Assembly in British Columbia. Next, we have Joseph Cansamilla, who was first elected to the Pittsburgh Board of Education at the age of 17, making him the youngest elected official in the nation. After serving almost four terms on the school board, Assemblyman Cansamilla served on the Pittsburgh City Council, where he was there for more than two terms, including 2 years as the mayor. He was elected to the Contra Costa County Board of Supervisors in 1996 and to the State Assembly in 2000, and he represents the 11th Assembly District. Since joining the state legislature, Assemblymember Cansamilla has been an outspoken advocate for reforming the way in which the legislature is elected and operates. To encourage more constructive dialogue and cooperation between Democratic and Republican legislators, Assemblyman Cansamilla and Assemblyman Keith Richman organized the Legislative Bipartisan Group, which regularly meets to discuss policy issues. Assemblyman Cansamilla also convenes the Assembly Democratic Moderate Caucus, which is a group of legislators dedicated to advancing California's economic competitiveness and improving our economy. Finally, later this week, Assemblyman Cansamilla and Assemblyman Keith Richman, and it may be even sooner than later this week, will be introducing legislation to establish a citizen assembly in California. Joining us today also is Vikram Amar. Professor Amar joined the Hastings faculty in 1998 after 5 years of teaching at the University of California at Davis School of Law. Professor Amar writes, teaches, and consults in the public law fields, especially constitutional law, civil procedure, and remedies. Much of his work has been in the area of direct democracy, including the institution of the jury. He authors a biweekly column on constitutional matters for findlaw.com and is a frequent commentator on local and national radio and television and has written dozens of op-ed pieces for newspapers and magazines. Professor Amar received a bachelor's degree in history from the University of California at Berkeley and his JD from Yale. He clerked for Judge William A. Norris of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit and then Justice Harry A. Blackmun of the United States Supreme Court. Our next panelist is Stephen Hill, director of the Political Reform Program of the New America Foundation. His latest book, 10 Steps to Repair American Democracy, will be published in May 2006. He is also the author of Fixing Elections, The Failure of America's Winner-Takes-All Politics. His articles and commentaries have appeared in dozens of newspapers and magazines, including the New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, Wall Street Journal, Christian Science Monitor, well, the usual suspects, shall we say. He has lectured widely in the United States and Europe and has appeared on C-SPAN, Fox News, National Public Radio, and numerous radio and television programs across the nation and in Europe. He was campaign manager in San Francisco of the successful effort that passed the instant runoff voting for local offices and was one of the organizers of San Francisco's successful efforts to enact public financing of campaigns in local elections. We are pleased to have this outstanding panel, and I would first like to call upon Steve Hill to begin the conversation.
Thank you, Judy. Thank you all to being here and for your interest in democracy in California and the United States. When you think about California and where we are in terms of our democracy, just to give you a bit of backdrop, we're near the bottom of the barrel in terms of voter turnout across the nation. Over 90% of our legislative seats are non-competitive races, pretty much done deals where we can tell you right now who's going to win most of the elections. Both parties are losing supporters. Independent voters are the fastest growing group. And voter frustration is everywhere, as evidenced just one example of a special election in which we threw out one governor, put in another, and then had another special election to reject all of the next governor's ballot measures, which was designed to somehow fix the problems of California. So we, against that backdrop, a number of promising reforms have been proposed, including independent redistricting commissions, term limits, open primaries, more modern electoral systems, public financing of campaigns, but all of them face the same obstacle, entrenched interests, including elected lawmakers who benefit from the status quo. One means of removing partisanship and incumbent protectionism, one that has recently emerged, an exciting vehicle, is what has become known as a Citizens Assembly, which convenes a body of average citizens empowered to formally propose electoral reforms that politicians have too strong a conflict of interest to propose themselves. Already successfully deployed in British Columbia, California's legislature, this week a bill will be introduced for a Citizens Assembly. So I'm going to talk a little bit now briefly about how the British Columbia Citizens Assembly worked and some of the details so we have that out front. The Citizens Assembly in British Columbia was established by the legislature with a mandate to focus exclusively on electoral reform. It wasn't going to get off into all sorts of other issues, health care, what have you. It was an exclusive focus on electoral reform. The Assembly's 160 members were chosen by a random selection process, like a jury pool. First, there was a draw of 100 men and 100 women from each of the 79 legislative districts in British Columbia that initial draw, they were asked, are you willing to be on the Citizens Assembly? If they were, then another random selection happened, and eventually they got it down to one woman and one man from each of 79 electoral districts in British Columbia. Two more representatives were added to ensure that representation of Native Canadians would be on the Citizens Assembly, and that comprised 160 members of the Citizens Assembly in British Columbia. The Assembly's tenure was divided into three phases. First, learning about the reforms that they were mandated to talk about and to deliberate about from noted experts in January and March of 2004. Second, from May to June, they held over 50 public hearings around the province of British Columbia. And third, final deliberations from September to November. They met on weekends. They did not meet during the week, so people who had jobs were able to keep their jobs. Their expenses and a per diem of approximately about $600 U.S. Was paid by the government for their service. They were addressed by top experts from all political perspectives who gave them the benefit of their knowledge and their analysis. Nearly 11 months later, in December 2004, the Assembly delivered its final report. The final proposal that they came up with, the vote was 146-7. So they achieved near consensus, and note that that was 153 voters. So out of 160 who originally started, only seven dropped out over the 11-month period. So the commitment was quite strong among the members of the Citizens Assembly. And they voted to toss out their long-time winner-take-all single-seat district election in favor of proportional representation. By previous agreement with the legislature, the Assembly's proposal automatically was submitted to the voters. So the members of the Assembly knew going in that this was serious business, what they were doing. What they were proposing was going to go in front of the voters. And it was submitted by the legislature directly to the voters in a referendum of May 2005. Because the Citizens Assembly was composed of average citizens, their recommendation had tremendous legitimacy with the public. A strong 58% of voters voted in favor of their proposal. Unfortunately, they needed 60% to pass it, but this unleashed such a momentum for reform that the legislature has now put the proposal back on the ballot for 2008, and that will be accompanied by a well-funded public education campaign to make sure voters understand it. I should also note that there was a chair person of the Citizens Assembly, a non-voting member, who was selected by the legislature and was oversaw the administration of this Citizens Assembly. The chair was a rather crucial position. The person who was selected was the former president of Simon Fraser University and, by all reports, did a remarkable job of being fair and nonpartisan in helping the Citizens Assembly to have the information they needed to make a good decision. The Citizens Assembly in British Columbia focused exclusively on the electoral system, but the focus could have been on other aspects of political reform, such as redistricting reform, campaign finance reform, the primary system, term limits, or even other electoral systems such as instant runoff voting. So, in other words, the Citizens Assembly is a vehicle for reform. What it focuses on in some ways is incidental to the vehicle itself. Now, a bill has been introduced into the California state legislature, or will be introduced this week. In many ways, this bill is mirroring the British Columbia model, as I've just described. There are a few differences that I'm just briefly going to lay out. Like in British Columbia, 160 members, one man and one woman, will be chosen from each of 80 assembly districts by a random draw, like a jury pool. However, there will be 10 members added as a top-up to ensure that the Citizens Assembly reflects the diversity of California and its people. Secondly, the California Citizens Assembly, rather than focusing single-mindedly on the electoral system, instead will be given several important democratic goals that it's trying to fulfill and to achieve, such as a more representative legislature, a less polarized representative body, more competitive choices for voters, and a reduction in special interest influence. And then they will be mandated to propose one or more political reforms that will achieve these goals, as I've described. The Citizens Assembly also in California will come up with their proposals, but then rather than putting it immediately on the ballot to the voters, it first will be submitted to the legislature. The legislature will have an opportunity to debate the Citizens Assembly proposals and to suggest revisions, and it's an attempt to draw the legislature into the process and hopefully make them partners in the process, because in no way is the Citizens Assembly trying to replace representative government. That's not the goal of the Citizens Assembly at all. Instead, the Citizens Assembly is merely trying to help us have better political process for electing better government. So we want to bring the legislature in. However, whatever the legislature proposes, the Citizens Assembly must agree to. The Citizens Assembly will be the final word on what goes on the ballot and what the voters actually vote on. And that's important in order to maintain the independence of the Citizens Assembly. So the Citizens Assembly solves a real dilemma. How do we enact meaningful political reform when political parties and their leaders have conflict of interest that induce them to manipulate the rules in their favor? While some propose using voter initiatives to go around special interests that often dominate the government, the best solution is using a citizens' assembly to reform the electoral process to increase the chances that we elect political leaders who are more representative and provide better governance. And in this sense, the citizens' assembly is in itself an improvement on the initiative process. So the citizens' assemblies could be important vehicles for modernizing our political system because trust is placed in a deliberative process involving average citizens who have more credibility than the political class. And that, in sum, is what we're trying to do in California, what they've done in British Columbia. And now, do I just turn it over to Gordon Gibson?
Thank you very much for that background. And I want to just remind the audience that if you have questions, there are cards, and they'll be picked up by volunteers, and we'll be able to incorporate those into our program today. Next, Gordon.
I'm going to stand up if I need for this section, Judy.
Well, thank you, Judy, and thank you all for coming. Thanks to the Commonwealth Club for hosting this event, to the New America Foundation for advancing this idea in the United States, especially to Assemblyman Canciamella and Richmond for advancing this idea in California. I'm just so enthused about it. And my purpose, after Steve's excellent outline of the nuts and bolts, if you like, in British Columbia, is to tell you how it actually worked. Because, in my opinion, this process is potentially the most important addition to the toolkit of direct democracy in 100 years. Since your own governor here, Hiram Johnson, introduced the initiative process in California. The Citizens' Assembly worked in British Columbia, and it worked well and at all levels. It started out as a new airplane, a design. It had never flown. Well, I can tell you this airplane flew, and it flew superbly well. It worked, first of all, for the public and the media. Both groups, from the beginning, had an immense respect for and interest in this assembly. Because, perhaps like California, in British Columbia, we have become very frustrated over the years with how our political process works. And this gave a bit of hope, because it was objective, neutral, representative, and empowered. Empowered in the sense, as Stephen noted, that it had the right to submit its recommendation directly to the people. So from the beginning, it was credible, and at the end, it was credible. It came up with a result, with a high degree of consensus, as Stephen said, a result that, to be honest, a lot of British Columbians didn't understand. The voting systems can be quite complicated. You know, their implications, their technicalities. But what the people of British Columbia said to themselves, I believe, was a group of people that looked a lot like us talked about this question for almost a year, and this is what they came up with, so we're going to support it. The required thresholds for the referendum to pass was a simple majority in 60% of the districts. In fact, it got a simple majority in 97% of the districts. Great support across the province. Secondly, I can go into the reasons as to why, if anyone's interested later, a very high threshold had been set by the legislature to make this law. 60% yes. In fact, it only got 58%. So it is not yet law. But to give you some idea of the force that this recommendation has in the province of British Columbia, even though it technically failed that referendum. The government has said, we are going to cause another vote to be held on this in 2008 after more information is available. So it's an enduring effect. If it was accepted by the public and the media, it was also accepted by the political class. Unanimously in public, the legislature voted unanimously to establish this body. I can tell you that in private, it was not always unanimously accepted, for the simple reason that legislators are human beings. This panel was to talk about electoral reform. People who are elected tend to think that the system that elected them is a pretty darn good system. I don't know whether to stir that one up or not. But nevertheless, in public, everybody went along, and the political class also respected the result. And in the referendum, the unspoken agreement among all of the politicians in British Columbia is we are not going to interfere in this. The electoral system belongs to the people and to the Citizens' Assembly, and the people will make up their own minds. And that is, in fact, how the referendum unfolded. How did it work for the Assembly members? Imagine if you're one of these 160 folks sitting down at the first meeting. You haven't met anybody else there. You probably know very little about the subject you're going to be asked to discuss. So you get there with a little bit of trepidation. You're not really sure that the government means it when they say they have empowered you. And that's how it started out. But they had a superb chair. They adopted excellent results, excellent protocols in their working together. And if you ask any of those people today, they will say this experience changed their lives because as ordinary citizens, they had been able to do something. They became huge fans of the process. They entered into an additional agreement among themselves on the very first day. This is how we're going to relate to each other. We're going to talk about ideas, not about people. We're going to respect each other. We are not going to make up our minds prematurely. And in fact, they had a formal rule. Nothing is decided until everything is decided. And so open minds were kept right throughout the process. There were no cliques. There were no jealousies. There was 99 or 98% attendance right through the piece. They developed a deep understanding of the topic. Genuine expertise was formed. And there was a huge consensus at the end. This success, I report to you, in a province that is just famously characterized for our nasty, polarized politics. We also have a reputation in Canada for a goofy kind of politics. Possibly California has that here. I don't know. In British Columbia, or rather in Canada, they say that in British Columbia we're famous for our political jokes, and we've elected many of them, and that's true. And there's been a lot of public cynicism, and a lot of what the public choice philosophers call rational ignorance, where people who just turned off the process. And that's why it's all the more remarkable that this thing worked. I want to underline a couple of points Stephen made. First of all, the narrow, focused mandate. You've got to tell these folks exactly what you want them to do. You don't want to say to them, go out and form us a better constitution, make us a better governmental system. If you do that, they will lose their way. Give them a narrowly focused mandate and say, do this precisely, please. The second reason you want a narrowly focused mandate is so the political class doesn't oppose this process. And there's two reasons they might want to oppose it. Reason number one is the fear of a what you might call a runaway assembly that just got its fingers into every pie without understanding it. And that is a genuine danger. The second reason is you don't want to set up the assembly as a rival to the legislature. Shouldn't be, can't be, and mustn't ever be presented in that way. It is a rare, very rare single-purpose device when politicians are deeply conflicted. Second point I would underline, the chair and the staff and the operating rules are very, very important. But a model has been developed there which you can follow if you choose. Is this transferable to California? A difference in size. We are a little over 4 million. You're over 30 million. My opinion is yes for a couple of reasons. First of all, I'll I'll give you the answer a pollster would give. A pollster will tell you that it doesn't matter whether he or she is sampling a population of 1 million or 10 million. 1,000 samples gives you the same accuracy of result, no matter what the size of the population, once they get up to that size. And we had 160 in British Columbia. In my opinion, 160 will do you perfectly well, too, in terms of representing the face of California, so that people looking at this assembly can say, yes, there's somebody there who looks very like me, maybe thinks like me, too. The second question is this. Given that California is so much bigger, can a citizens' assembly deal with the huge complexity of the state? Well, my answer here is this. British Columbia has one legislature. California has one legislature. France, which is double the size of California, has one legislature. So my answer is yes, one assembly can deal with your problems just like it dealt with ours. A second question which was raised in a meeting we had in Los Angeles yesterday and is a very good one. What about the diversity profiles? Are they different? California being a very diverse society, ethnically, even now linguistically. British Columbia, I can tell you, is much the same. We are an immigrant society, like you are. About half of our population are immigrants, 25% from the rest of Canada, and 25% from foreign lands. Something like in the Vancouver School District, Chinese is the language spoken at home in 33 of the households. Chinese population in British Columbia is about 15% of the province, Indo-Canadian about 7%, other mixtures, and we are diverse as you are. Diversity can be captured by the assembly and represented. The lessons I learned from the BC experience. The first lesson is this. The Citizens' Assembly is a very, very powerful tool. It can deal with the kind of institutional inertia that you find in political processes that have become encrusted over a century or more. It has the prestige, the credibility to gain the public acceptance to allow you to do that. A powerful tool. Secondly, it's a special tool for very rare use, at least until we know a lot more about it. It's ideal when the problems are intractable and long-standing and apparently incapable of resolution in any other way, and also when politicians are conflicted. And politicians are inherently and deeply conflicted when it comes to redesigning electoral systems. So if you want to redesign an electoral system, as you may wish to do, this is the instrument to use for it. A third thing I've learned is that the support of political leaders is very important. Try and sell this to your political class. It's not in California as it was in British Columbia indispensable. It simply wouldn't have happened in British Columbia had not our premier, our chief executive officer, said this is going to happen. In California, you can, if you wish, institute this sort of thing through your initiative process, but it is a huge advantage if the political class is on side. And so I again congratulate the two assemblymen. My overall conclusion is this. I'm a Democrat in the same way that a lot of people are religious. I'm a Democrat because of faith. And my article of faith is that the citizenry has the innate capacity to govern itself. This is just a belief. Or until recently, for me, it was just a belief. When I was designing this thing at the request of the BC government, I was over in Victoria, which is our capital. And I came back on one of our large ferries and walked around the ferry. There were 1,000 people aboard this ferry. I walked up and down and around, and I looked at these people, and I said, my God, would I trust something important to this crowd? I was worried. But we went ahead with it, and I can tell you, it worked out so well that I can tell you, as a Democrat, seeing that assembly work would be like a Christian seeing God. It was just that good. So my humble advice to you is try it one time with a modest and constrained mandate Get it going, and once you get it going, the political class will come along. They won't. They'll be afraid of opposing it. That's what happened in British Columbia. And down the road, you might dream larger dreams and find other ways of using it. For the moment, the specific proposal advanced by the Assemblymen and the New American Foundation is an excellent start, and I heartily commend it to your attention. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that discussion. You're listening to the program Reconnecting Californians to Their Government Through Citizens' Assemblies, which is hosted by the Commonwealth Club of California's Voices of Reform Project and the New American Foundation. Now it is my pleasure to introduce Assemblyman Joseph Cansamilla, who is going to tell us about his legislation and how it affects California.
Thank you, and thanks as well to the Commonwealth Club and to the New America Foundation for all their help and support, and all of you for taking time out of your day to be here today. Steve and Mr. Gibson have talked extensively about the process and the mechanism. Let me talk a little bit about what we face today in California, why this came about as an option, and a little bit about our dysfunctional system's ability to process this and perhaps move it through. If you recall, way back 6 years ago, we had a $10 billion surplus in this state. No one had even heard of an energy crisis. The governor was Gray Davis, and there was a very positive and upbeat spirit about where we were going. Democrats controlled the Assembly, the Senate, as well as the governor's office. All things were good. Within a narrow window of time, it all fell apart. And it fell apart not because we couldn't deal with the problems, but because we chose not to. When I arrived in the legislature, there was just the beginning of an energy crisis. There was just the beginnings, just the hint that we were going to be facing some potential shortages in Southern California. Within the next few weeks, we began to go through a period of brownouts, then blackouts in Southern California. The legislature then raced to have task forces, meetings, subcommittees, committees, hearings up and down the state. We spent months and months and months working on energy reform. And here we are, 6 years later, still facing a structural deficit as a result of the money that was spent during that crisis. And no energy policy. We still face the same basic imbalance in the system that we faced 6 years ago. I could repeat that story and that same scenario when it comes to the budget, when it comes to electoral reform, when it comes to any of the health care, housing, any of the major issues. And having sat there for 5 years and grown increasingly frustrated, I can tell you that the system is not going to change until the public demands a change in the way members are elected, in how districts are drawn, and the electoral reform that will address campaign finance reform and will force members to get out into their districts and talk to constituents and be held accountable. That doesn't happen today. If you're elected in a safe primary, you're there for 6 years or 8 years in the Senate. There's nothing that forces you to reach an agreement, to come to a compromise, to work with the other side. Governor Schwarzenegger was elected in a recall of historic proportion. Many Californians, whether they supported it or not, viewed this as an opportunity for real fundamental change in the way this state operates. I viewed it that way. I was extremely hopeful that like him or not, here was a chance for somebody who owed nothing to anyone to come in and force a dialogue that would address these kinds of issues. 2 years later, here we are. Back in the same, and I'd argue, a worse position than we were prior to the recall, because not only have we failed in the efforts for reform, not only have they gone unaddressed, but the governor is now in a position where he's trying to move even further backwards in order to accommodate the concerns of both sides of the political extremes. What's the solution? Keith and I started a group three, four years ago, a bipartisan group, Republicans and Democrats sitting down together to talk about politics, talk about legislation, talk about issues of the day. Our first few meetings, we had to hold outside the Capitol building in secret because members were afraid to be seen sitting down talking to members of the other party. And the moment that word leaked out that there were some members doing this, there were two editorials in the Orange County Register condemning the Republican members who would dare to sit down with Democrats because God knows we were going to give them the Kool-Aid that would force them to vote for a tax increase. And how dare they sit down in an accommodation with the other side? Two editorials in a span of less than 4 days, and we lost members in the group because of that. That's the kind of dysfunctional system that still continues in Sacramento today. We've tried legislative reforms to get redistricting improvements, open primaries, campaign finance reform. All of them have failed. We introduced a bill 2 years ago that was recognized by Common Cause as the best redistricting solution, couldn't get a second in a committee, introduced it again this past year, couldn't even get it referred to a committee so that we could have it die for lack of a second. There is no way a system dominated by special interest groups, dominated by this kind of partisan gridlock is going to address issues of major import, much less issues that talk about how those members get elected. So a year ago, we began the process of trying to figure out what alternatives are out there. We spent weeks talking to academics, to reporters, columnists, people with experience in the issue, people that had served on the Constitutional Revision Commission. And everyone said, we know the system's broken, we know it's dysfunctional, but we're not going to sit for another 2 years on a Constitution Revision Commission and have the report sit on a shelf. You've got to find another way. And that's when we were fortunate enough to discover the New America Foundation. We were fortunate enough to find Mr. Gibson and the folks in British Columbia and begin to look at this alternative. Now, this alternative is different. It scares a lot of my colleagues, because it calls for turning over the decision-making authority. It calls for giving them control over the dialogue. It's also unique because it's going to require the public to accept a two-phase process. One, assuming it gets through the legislature, and we'll be introducing the bill today, announcing it tomorrow, it's going to require a two-thirds vote in both the Assembly and the Senate to get out. Does not constitutional amendment doesn't require the governor's signature, but it will require a two-thirds vote. That means Democrats and Republicans have to come together to agree to change the system. Then it would go on the ballot, because in order to do this, we have to amend the Constitution to permit the Citizens' Assembly to exist and to put their recommendations directly on the ballot. Right now, the only way that can happen is through the initiative, through the legislature, or through a constitutional convention. And we looked for a moment, a brief moment, at the possibility of calling a constitutional convention. And our fear was, in a dysfunctional environment, calling a constitutional convention where there's no limitation on what they could do would create a tremendously dysfunctional result. This is a narrowly focused effort that will be not only approved by the voters in order to constitute itself, but the recommendations would then go back to the voters for final approval. There are two checks where the voters have a say. Why is that important? We're a state of 35-plus million people, and fewer than a third of the voters have any faith and confidence in either the legislature or the governor to create real change or to fix the problems that we face. The Citizens' Assembly is important not only because it can address the problems themselves, redistricting, open primary, the kind of voting systems we use, but they can engage the public. They can allow for a reinvestment by the public in the democratic process and hopefully to rebuild the confidence in not only the Citizens' Assembly, but in the government itself to be able to address these kinds of issues and the bigger issues that the state faces. Unless we break this partisan divide and unless we get past the kind of dysfunction that we've seen in this state in the last few years, we're never going to address the big issues. We're never going to address the issues of health care, housing, budget. We're still sitting with a deficit. We talk about reform. We couldn't even get a bill passed that required that we taped committee meetings in the legislature. You know, we don't even record all the meetings in the legislature. You can't go to a planning commission meeting here without having it recorded. We don't do that in the legislature, and we couldn't get that bill through. So when you look at a system that is so dysfunctional that it kills even that kind of reform, the bigger effort is going to have to be taken in a much different way. And we think that the Citizens' Assembly is a way to get there.
Thank you, Senator. Our final speaker, and I encourage you to continue to forward those questions. We have quite a few, and we're going to take as many as we can for this program. Our final speaker is Professor Vikram Amar. Professor?
I'm delighted to be here today, and I want to begin by expressing my gratitude for having been invited. When Steve Hill asked me to join this quite impressive panel, I wasn't quite sure what perspective I could really add that would be particularly helpful. I'm not intimately versed with the details of the proposed legislation, but I thought that maybe as a constitutional generalist and someone who's written extensively about various forms of direct democracy, I could give you some sense of how this current enterprise fits into the larger constitutional landscape. No idea has been more central to American constitutionalism than the idea of popular sovereignty, the notion that the people, or more particularly a majority of them, have an inalienable right to structure and alter their form of government. Now, that doesn't mean, of course, that the citizenry does or should always directly run the day-to-day affairs of state. At the national and at the local level, the people have ordained and established systems of representative government to do the people's bidding. But as the framers well understood, and as you've heard echoes of here today, those representatives have incentives that don't always align with the people's. Indeed, what we academics call the agency problem, the notion that an agent might have a temptation to betray the principal. In this case, elected representatives might have temptation to act differently than the people might want. That agency problem was a bigger concern on the minds of the framers, I would say, than the so-called tyranny of the majority that we've become kind of fixated with in the past 50 years after Brown versus the Board of Education, and rightly so to some extent. But if you asked the founding generation, in what way are legislatures scary? It was not so much that they would be the organs for allowing majorities to oppress victimized minorities. There was some of that. But there was a greater fear that the agents, the representatives, would turn on the majorities of people who elected them in the first place. Well, what are we to do when agents, our representatives, are not acting faithfully to the people's interests? Direct democracy in a variety of forms has been America's answer. But the knock on direct democracy, and nowhere is that knock heard louder than here in California, is that direct democracy tends to be reflexive and impassioned rather than deliberate and careful. And that is a big knock indeed, because popular sovereignty, the foundation of American constitutionalism, does not mean and has never meant that a majority has a right to do anything it wants, anytime, in any way. As my older brother, who is also a constitutional scholar on the East Coast, has put the point, majority rule does not imply majority will, or certainly not majority whim. That is why when early Americans made their most important decision, whether to ratify the United States Constitution itself, they did so through the device of conventions, specially assembled representatives chosen for the single task and people not take a part of the regular ongoing government who could deliberate, hear the best arguments on all sides, and carry on a conversation that for practical reasons would be impossible for the polity at large to have. The Citizens' Assembly that you're hearing about today is in many ways reminiscent of the founding era idea of citizens meeting in conventions. The Citizens' Assembly involves a group of representatives who are not part of the standing government and for that reason who are not conflicted, but who are nonetheless empowered in legally relevant ways to meet, discuss, deliberate, and act, or at least begin acting. As Assemblyman Cansamilla pointed out, the people at large have another moment down the road to embrace or reject the proposed reforms on particular issues on behalf of citizens. Now, one big difference between 18th century conventions and the Citizens' Assembly being discussed here today is the mode of appointment. Representatives of Citizens' Assembly are not elected for this one-shot job the way representatives to the constitutional conventions were. Instead, they are chosen at lot. But that device, too, the device of a lottery, has or taps into a deep constitutional vein, conjuring up analogies, as Steve mentioned earlier, to the jury, which is another deliberative, non-governmental body called upon to do government in specific instances. In a very real but underappreciated way, law is what juries say law means. Juries are representative, even though they are not elected, because they are cross-representational. They are drawn from all among us. No single juror has an incentive to represent any particular constituency in the sense of being answerable to that group, but collectively jurors bring all constituencies into the conversation. And perhaps even more than constitutional conventions, the analogy of the jury may be a relevant one to think about in connection with the Citizens' Assembly. Indeed, if you expand your notion of a jury beyond the Pettit jury of 12 persons who actually decide cases to the institution of grand juries that sit for more than one case and who do more than hand down criminal indictments but also propose reforms to local government leaders in a lot of jurisdictions, the Citizens' Assembly is kind of a larger version of a well-operating grand juries, and I think the jury analogy is very helpful. As a constitutionalist, I'm excited by these analogies and the relationships between the Citizen Assembly idea and the intellectual predecessors of the Constitutional Convention and the jury. But these analogies also cause me to ask a few questions, some of which maybe we can explore a little later, but let me put a few on the table. First, I'm troubled a bit by the volunteerism aspect of the membership of the Citizens' Assembly. I think if you ask what is most wrong with the American jury system today, it is that it relies on volunteerism too much. To the extent that American juries sometimes, and I say sometimes rather than often because I think criticism is overstated, to the extent that American juries sometimes do things that don't accord with American common sense, it's because we've structured juries so that they don't really look like America. They make decisions for America, but they don't really look like America. Anybody with anything better to do works hard and usually successfully to get off a jury. And then on top of that, we empower lawyers who have their own set of incentives to pick jurors off using the device of peremptory challenges, with the result being that juries don't really, speak for and aren't very representative of the communities they're supposed to serve. So I think we need to be returning to a sense of civic obligation, not just civic volunteerism and civic opportunity. And there are, I think, some enforcement mechanisms that we could talk about that might take time to implement, but I'd prefer that we really draw people by lot and then have them serve rather than just ask them, would you want to serve? And I say there are some enforcement mechanisms we can get into maybe down the road. But one reason why some people may say no to the Citizens' Assembly, this is my second of the two big questions I want to ask, relates to the length of service that we might be asking of these people. To the extent that the California plan is going to be modeled after the British Columbia experience, I understand that the British Columbia Citizens' Assembly sat for across a whole year. And that may be great, but a year is a long time to ask people to commit. And so down the road, I mean, I think, you know, obviously you want to start with one experiment, but as we tinker with the concept of a citizen assembly and make it better going forward, I think we should reflect back on the jury analogy and realize that one of the reasons that a lot of jurors kind of try to shirk is because cases take too long. I think in our adult lifetimes, the example of the O.J. Simpson criminal trial jumps out. I mean, that was a trial that lasted over a year that could have lasted 3 weeks. Now, obviously, to consider a package of electoral reforms going to take more than a few days, but I would try to be sensitive to that if I was trying to impose an obligation to serve. So anyway, we can talk about some of those practical issues a little bit more, but my bottom line is this is a very exciting idea for academics as well as for the real world. It kind of blends some of the best of both, and I encourage all of you to really contact your representatives and urge them to take a close look.
Thank you, Professor. You're listening to a discussion of reconnecting Californians to their government through citizens' assemblies, hosted by the Commonwealth Club of California's Voices of Reform Project and the New America Foundation. Well, I want to thank all of our panelists for giving us a great background, and that has prompted many, many questions, so I'm going to get right into those. They kind of come... I've organized them really by a couple of central themes. There are several questions around the mechanics of both the British Columbia and the proposed California program, around representation, around campaign finance and the influence of money or potential influence of money on this proposal, and then around civic engagement and continuing involvement of the community. So I'll start with asking... I'm putting several of these together because they're relatively the same. The question is about the Citizens Alliance and having sole authority to propose electoral reform, if that is in fact such an important and significant charge for them, then number one, how can we give them any more legitimacy than any previously convened Blue Ribbon panels or other citizen-based groups, number one? And how do we know, we take it on faith perhaps, that they are not being influenced by other interests or special interests? And then just to add to that, there was a question regarding how the mechanics of it, how would the Citizen Assembly be able to function as their permanent staff, and would there in fact be the possibility of some influence? So, putting those all together, I'm actually looking at the assemblyman for some answers on that.
Well, I think those are all very good questions, and they're questions that I think that we've tried to address as we've moved forward with it. As to the question of the selection process and the legitimacy of the process. It is a random selection of individuals in each assembly district. Once that random group was selected, they would have an opportunity to attend an overview where they would be given information about what it is they would be getting into. They would then have to volunteer to go into the next round where there'd be a random selection. The group would then, once they were seated and you had the full citizens' assembly as well as a group of potential alternates that were selected, you would have the selection of the chair and then the staffing options. Staffing is originally done through the academic institutions. We would utilize resources that are available out there. You could not be a member of the citizens' assembly and there's a whole set of criteria in the bill, but you can't be connected to anyone in immediate family, in elective office, that's a lobbyist, that has had any specific contact with basically the governmental structure you're trying to reform. Couldn't be a member of the legislature, couldn't be elected to local or state office, couldn't be a judge, couldn't be a delegate or a member of a state, county, or local political party. So you couldn't be a member of a Democrat or a Republican Central Committee. You could not have provided campaign-related service to a political campaign or a candidate, couldn't be a registered lobbyist. We've tried to narrow it down so that there would be a narrow range of people. All the meetings are public. All the meetings are, there is no provision in here for a closed session or a executive session. Everything is public. Everything would be subject to open meeting rules and would be also, they would meet a requirement of having public hearings around the state.
Okay, anyone else to comment on that? There have been several questions about the amount of money in Canadian politics, and the questioner asks whether or not that compares to U.S. politics, and again, speaking to the possible influence of special interests, could that derail this on the assembly side? In other words, would the not even looking at the ability to be impartial by the Citizens Assembly, but would the California legislature, in fact, be influenced to take a position against this based on economic campaign contributions?
Absolutely. I mean, the biggest challenge that we face is getting this through the legislature with a two-thirds vote in both houses. The reality is you're asking the legislature to do several things. One, give up control over something that would affect every member directly, if not indirectly. Secondly, asking them to give up the ability to use those dysfunctional processes to their advantage. I mean, it hasn't changed because it works. The lobbyists know how it works. The members know how it works. We all recognize that it's dysfunctional and doesn't solve problems, but we all know how it works. So we've gotten comfortable with that design, and we know what the rules are. But trying to change that is going to be very difficult, and you know, Keith and I are both prepared to have to move this through an initiative process, but we would prefer not to. We would prefer that this be addressed by the legislature, and that's going to take the effort of folks like yourselves that are here and listening that tell their members to take a serious look at this.
Indeed, if this bill weren't difficult to pass, it wouldn't be necessary.
That's a very good point.
There's
That's
a thought.
Absolutely very good point. Yes.
This is for Mr. Gibson. Did the Citizens Assembly in Canada truly engage the citizens of British Columbia? And what was the level of engagement after the project was completed? And tied to this is a question regarding the representation on the Citizens Assembly, as you've described it, to the attempt to have it be broadly representative. And a member of the audience is questioning whether or not that also included groups such as the disabled community in your attempt to be broad in your representation.
First of all, on the topic of representativeness, we made a deliberate decision to stratify along only three dimensions: geography, gender, and age, for a couple of reasons. For the practical reason that that is what our voters list could tell us, and we were using the voters list as a sample universe to draw a random sample. But also because we were of the view that a sample size of 160 would, in fact, just through the laws of statistics, produce a pretty representative group. And, in fact, that is what happened. We're fortunate that we're fortunate to have studies here. The professional staff of the Assembly knew that this was going to be studied down the road. So they have issued a technical document of considerable length, which you will find at the Assembly's website. Even though the Assembly's dissolved, their website with all the information continues. It's www.citizensassembly.bcca. In that, you will find study evidence that shows that, in fact, this body, along socioeconomic dimensions and including things like disability, in fact, did represent the province of British Columbia pretty darn well. So that, in my opinion, is not a fluke. That is simply a result of the law of large numbers, which is one of the things you learn about in statistics class. In terms of engagement, there were 50 public hearings held around the province. Something like, I think it was 2,700 people attended. I think there were 1,600 written submissions made in addition. Many of the assembly members read all of them. So certainly the public had all of the opportunity it wanted to be engaged. As a practical matter, only activists and political scientists and people who for one reason or another were really interested in this kind of thing did take the time to become engaged, because people said, as they say reasonably, look, we're asking you folks to study this for us. We want you to become the experts, and please do that. We're not going to do your job for you. So I'm not going to claim to you that every British Columbian was demanding a chance to be at the public hearings, but the public hearings were certainly held, and an incredibly diverse range of viewpoints were heard. There were some attempts to overpower these public hearings in the sense of one organized group in particular would have several speakers appear at every meeting. This in fact backfired, because the assembly members very quickly saw, well, this is we see what's going on here, and we're not going to pay any attention to it. The public engagement was good.
Very good. Thank you.
Can I add one point to that?
Yes.
The bill for the California says this out. In British Columbia, they spent about, what, $5 to $6 million U.S. for the cost of the assembly. The bill that's been going to be introduced has it will have $20 million, and some of that money is designed to not only run the Citizens Assembly, but also to do extensive outreach to Californians to let them know that this Citizens Assembly is occurring, how they can plug into the process, and how they can be involved. So you know, we did give some thought to how to really try to engage Californians with this.
Well, you answered one question I had, but I have another one for you, Mr. Hill. In your comments, you noted that the independents are the fastest-growing group of voters. Given the entrenched partisanship and special interest corruption of our current system, the questioner asks, how do you see the role of independent voters in enacting reforms?
I think independent voters, I think by being independent, for one, you're speaking loudly and clearly that you're not quite thrilled with what the two major parties are doing. But I think beyond that, I think, you know, we're talking about reform, and that's what clearly needs to happen in California. And to the extent that independent voters become involved in reform efforts, running for office as an independent candidate and letting people know, giving voters another choice. I know it's difficult as an independent candidate, but it's important to be out there and try to represent that point of view. And in terms of the Citizens Assembly, I think that independent voters, have more to gain from this process conceivably than anyone else. So getting your legislator to support the bill that's going to be introduced this week would be extremely important.
And a follow-up to that, is it possible in your judgment that this, should the Citizens Assembly here in California be successful, would this ultimately be able to encourage non-voters to become voters, in your opinion?
Well, non-voters don't vote for a lot of reasons, and certainly feeling that their vote doesn't count for very much is a big part of that. So to the extent that the reforms, the Citizens Assembly could help produce a political process where their vote would actually count for something, I think, sure, there's no question. I mean, when you look at the fact that we can tell you right now who's going to win over 90% of the races in California, both for U.S. House and for state legislature, it means that for the voter, there's not a whole lot of reason to turn out. There's not a lot of reasons for the representative to come and ask you for your vote, because they know it's a done deal. The real game, they know, is in the primary, if there's a contested primary at all. I mean, these are the dynamics of our political system that, when you add it all up, it turns into a situation where voters just have this general sense that your vote doesn't count for very much. So part of what we're trying to do here is in a long-term project, is make your vote count for something and make you feel like it's important to vote. Make it feel like, I mean, like as I mentioned earlier, California has one of the lowest voter turnouts in the United States. And I don't think it's because people are content. I mean, you can read opinions from columnists like George Will and Charles Krauthammer and others that will tell you, well, people don't vote because they're satisfied. Well, the problem with that is that we know who does and who doesn't vote. The people who don't vote overwhelmingly are racial minorities, poor people, young people, people who you'd think would have least reasons to be satisfied. And so it's really about giving these constituencies something to vote for that is not just a politician coming to you every 4 years and making some, vague promises about, well, you should vote for me because if you don't, you're going to get the other person and they're going to be worse, That's really, I mean, a lot of voters today vote against something rather than for something. That's just how voters are, you know. And in my own family, I've come from a large family, and I talk to them a lot about these things from all sorts of range of viewpoints. And it's clearly that's the dynamic. They're voting against a candidate, not for a candidate. And we really need to turn that around. And so I think that when we have a political system where voters can vote for something instead of against something, then we'll be making progress.
Thank you. A question for Professor Amar. And this really is, I think, touches a little bit on your comments about jury selection and how that process works. And the question is that if the representatives of the pool of people are randomly selected and accept the nomination, are skills and qualifications taken into account? And if it is completely random, can the selection of the assembly in itself be considered democratic? Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I think, you know, representative is a word that has meant different things in the American constitutional tradition. Sometimes we think of a representative the way we think of Assemblyman Cansamilla, someone who we select and who kind of has to take our interest into account because he wants us to reselect him subject to the term limits we've imposed upon him. But there's another sense in which someone is a representative, and that is that they just come from the community. And jurors are representative not in their individual sense that they each kind of speak for a constituency that picked them, but rather if we truly do have randomness across a large number of people, then those who are selected are going to mirror the population at large. They're going to mirror the demographics. They're going to mirror the attitudes. And with respect to the jury as an institution, we haven't done a good job of kind of retaining that cross-sectional quality because we've allowed too many exceptions to come in and pick people off so that, you know, the people who decide cases in juries are not kind of socioeconomically and demographically typical of Americans. Now, it's true that not every American has the same skill level, has the same education background, the same sophistication, but when you put them all together, the differences kind of wash out, and the strength that each person has kind of makes up for the shortcomings that someone else might have. That's what diversity at its best is all about. Now, I know that there are mechanisms in place to try to make sure that the groups that are selected for the Citizens Assembly really do have demographic representational qualities to them, even if only certain people volunteer. But, for example, if unemployed people who can't devote the time to serve on one of these assemblies because it's a long commitment, I want to make sure we have good mechanisms for having their voice included and the like. Coming in after the fact and tinkering with the pool you've got by some kind of blue ribbon or task force or some academics coming in and trying to jigger things after the fact, that may be the best we can do now. But in the long run, I'd rather have a system where we compensate the people who serve on these citizens' assemblies at a good enough rate that no one has a kind of an incentive to try to shirk, and we just really proceed randomly. Randomness is representation at its best.
Thank you.
I want to make one point. And the legislation, I believe, calls for a compensation of $1,000 per month for each member of the Citizens' Assembly. And as in British Columbia, we envision that they would meet every other weekend, Saturday and Sunday. So, you know, there would be a time commitment there, but it's not like they're going to be giving up their entire lives for this process. And in fact, we want them to be going back to their communities and talking to their neighbors and, you know, having a conversation over the fence about, you know, what do you think about these types of reforms and these sorts of things. We're hoping that this is going to actually increase the civicness and the civic dialogue in California in as part of the process.
And by the way, and that's one big respect in which this is a big improvement on the jury system. In California, you know, we pay jurors, you know, $5 a day, not $1,000 a month.
Right.
Thank you. This really is for both Assemblyman Cansamilla and Mr. Gibson, because it is a comparison question regarding the comparison between the two, British Columbia Citizens Assembly and the Assemblyman's proposal. And it talks about the broader mandate and tasks at hand. And is it possible, actually, if the time allotted to do this in California would be the same as that which was given in British Columbia, would the Citizens Assembly here in California be spread too thin if they were considering a wide array of issues, and would it be better just to look at only a few very specific ones?
Well, there is a very narrow range of authority granted to the Citizens Assembly. When we talk about electoral reform, it's a fairly narrow range. And as part of our discussions, and certainly we're welcome as the bill hopefully begins to move through to engage in more dialogue on this, but we're torn between Professor Amar's concern about, is it too much time, is it too long, is it going to be too much of a burden, versus you could take as long as you wanted to on these subjects. I mean, Lord knows the legislature could certainly and has taken years and years and years to talk about these without a resolution. So we think having a finite period of time, it will help to force the Citizens Assembly to focus more directly on issues, prioritize them, and if we need to do it again, then they can put their recommendations on the ballot and we can start on the next round. But we think this is a good start.
A couple of other questions. Again, these are a little bit on the mechanics, but I think they're important because they get to the feasibility, I think, in the eyes of the voter as to whether or not this project would work. We've heard about what the budget is, the proposed budget. This is a question regarding the direct and indirect costs and if there are any checks and balances in place should the assembly become dysfunctional, start engaging in partisanship, or shows incompetence or that they're wildly off track. And a follow-up to that is, are there any risks to doing this?
There are provisions in here for expelling members for cause. Would require two-thirds vote of the remaining members of the Citizens Assembly in order to do that. We specifically didn't put a lot of criteria in here. They're subject to Robert's Rules of Order. We didn't want to get into trying to tell them how to do what it is they will do. Is there a risk? Yeah, there's a risk that they could get off track. There is a risk that they might come up with a scheme that the public doesn't support. But that risk, we believe, is balanced by the public having the ultimate say in whether the recommendation should be adopted. I would argue that the greater risk is that the good recommendations or positive recommendations that may come out of a citizens' assembly will be attacked by the interest groups that don't want them to be adopted, and the public will then be making decisions, as we've seen more often than not, with 15-second TV commercials and 30-second radio spots and an onslaught of money. That's my fear more so than the process becoming dysfunctional.
And potentially the even greatest risk of all is doing nothing. If you do this and it doesn't work, I'm sure it will work, but if it doesn't work, what have you lost? $20 million and some people's time. And what if it does work? What have you won? You've won a huge prize. To me, this is a very solid bet to place.
Yeah, and I would also add that I don't think it's, if the public doesn't agree with what the Citizens Assembly comes up with, but the process itself is viewed as fair and a good process for proposing things to the public, I think that's success. You know, there's no guarantee that the public will agree with the Citizens Assembly. However, that's not a reason not to go forward. I think that if we can come up with a good process here, we're essentially inventing, or British Columbia's already invented it, we're trying to now import it to California, a new vehicle for political reform. That's really what we're trying to do here, and using a lot of modern methods about being able to make random selections and what have you to empower a group of average citizens in a way that they really have never been empowered before since perhaps the New England town meeting, and then maybe even not then. So that really, to me, is the more exciting part here, and not focusing so much on will the voters vote for it and what will they ultimately propose. I mean, if we start getting into that and figuring out whose ox is going to get gored and all these sorts of things, and everyone starts burrowing down into their self-interest, that's what we're trying to rise above with the Citizens Assembly process.
This is another mechanical question, perhaps, on how the process works, but we all know that the decisions that you make are only as good as the information that you receive. So how are the information resources for the Citizen Assembly selected?
They'll have an opportunity to do a lot of that selection themselves. I mean, the resources as a member of the legislature, the resources that are available to me are incredible. The resources of the CSU, USC system, of the various state agencies and departments, those are all be available to the Citizens Assembly as well.
I wonder if, Gordon, you could talk about what the chair did for the Citizens Assembly in British Columbia and how they accumulated the information. I mean, I think that's an important part of this.
Well, there's, on all of these questions of democratic reform, there's an immense body of thought out there. The problem is never what are the possible answers. There's so many of them that the problem is winnowing them down. If an assembly is properly provided with a good neutral chair, a facilitator, and a director of research who makes sure that all of the ideas are brought in an objective and neutral fashion to the attention of the assembly, and if the assembly people themselves are given the ability to ask questions and ask for the importation of further resources, bring me somebody from Ireland where they have a particular campaign finance system, whatever it might be, then you're going to get everything you need to think about this.
Other comments?
No.
Okay. There is also a question about the position that the governor may or may not take on this. Do you have a sense yet or as to where the governor stands on this Citizens Assembly?
No, we don't. And as I indicated, the governor is not required to sign this legislation, but the governor's support would certainly be helpful and welcome as he has the larger bully pulpit and would certainly be able to influence the Republicans in the House to advance this and move it forward. But it doesn't require his approval.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're at that time in the program where we have just time for one last question, and so I'll ask actually every one of our panelists if you have some thoughts for us on how can we build public support for taking the citizen assembly approach in California.
Shall we start?
Okay, I was waiting. I'll go first. Sure. Well, in the vein of a citizens assembly, it really starts with you. There will be a bill introduced. There will be a bill number as of tomorrow. In fact, let me you can go to the website newamerica.net/citizensassembly, and there you'll see a link to the British Columbia Citizens Assembly website, and we will try to get the bill number up on there, on that website. So if you go there and you find the bill number. So start going out there and building support. I'm sure you all have email. Start emailing things. If you go to the Citizens Assembly page, you'll see there links to articles that have been in the Los Angeles Times, Sacramento Bee. Just yesterday, another Sacramento Bee columnist came out with a column, Daniel Weintraub, saying, you know, this idea has merit. And start sending those articles around to people. We're at the beginning of something where we need people to understand what we're doing and what it's about, and I think all of you can help with that. So I'm optimistic. This is a great start. And we're doing this also tomorrow in Sacramento, as well as holding a press conference tomorrow in Sacramento. And after this week, we'll see where it goes.
Other thoughts?
I guess I would just add that, you know, when skeptics kind of recoil at the novelty of this kind of an approach, you should remind people that, you know, we're living in the greatest experiment in human history, and that's the American enterprise. And it's kind of nothing is more American than kind of experimenting to try to improve what we've got.
Well, thank you very much to our panelists. We have had the pleasure of hearing Stephen Hill, director of the Political Reform Program at the New America Foundation, Gordon Gibson, former member of the Legislative Assembly of British Columbia, Assemblyman Joseph Kansamila, and Professor Vikram Amar, Professor of Law at the University of California, Hastings. We'd also like to thank our audiences here and on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.